welcome. I want to welcome each one of you to our worship service today. Happy December. I would like to read to you from the book of John, the Gospel of John, chapter 13, verses 34 and 35. You'll recall that I told you a story about Elder John Leland, who was a famous Primitive Baptist elder back at the time of the Revolutionary War. He was a very instrumental man. He had great influence on several of our founding fathers. And as I've set forth to you before, I'm of the opinion that he had a great influence on our First Amendment, the Bill of Rights. He was a great advocate for the religious freedom of all men. But there was a time whenever he was visiting, filling an appointment, and he was not treated well because he was rather shabby. He traveled, and his hair was disheveled. And when he appeared to stay the night with the man who was in charge of the church, he didn't recognize that it was the great John Leland who had come to visit him, and so he treated him rather shabbily. And he asked this old beggar how many commandments were there, and he said, 11. He says, oh my goodness, 11 commandments. I got to take you to church. So he followed him along, and they got to church, and the man stood down front, and he says, I'm sorry, but John Leland wasn't able to be with us. And at that time, he turns around, and the beggar had gotten into the stand because it was John Leland. And he said, my sermon today is the 11th commandment. The 11th commandment. And that's what I want to read to you today. This is John chapter 14, verses 34 and 35. This is our Lord Jesus speaking. He says, a new commandment I give unto you, that you love one another. As I have loved you, that ye also love one another. By this shall all men know that ye are my disciples, if ye have love one to another. It's a new commandment, but it's really not new. It's old. It's really all of the law and the prophets are bound up in this commandment. And yet it's also new because it's realized through the person and the work of Jesus Christ. You know, there's another time when Jesus was asked, what's the great commandment? He said, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, soul, strength, and mind. And this is another commandment like that, that thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Now, those are very good commandments, and we ought to also follow them. But notice that Jesus here expands that a little bit, doesn't he? He expands it. He says, I don't want you just to love each other the way you love yourself. I want you to love each other the way I love you. How about that? How about that for a standard? I want you to love each other the way I have loved you and do love you. That's the mark of the church. That's the mark of Christ's followers. When we have love one to another. And I pray, and I'm thankful to God that we have such a love here. Everywhere where God's people are together and the Spirit of God is given liberty and this commandment is followed, God is glorified. But let's keep that in mind, that we are to love one another, just not as we love ourselves, but in the measure of love that Christ has given us. And think about all that he did, all that he bore, all that he suffered, all the shame, all the pain, that he did it gladly, that the joy that was set before him, that he might redeem his people and live with them forever in eternity. That's love. And that's the love that ought to mark our lives as we walk in this world. So that's something to be thankful for. And don't you think? Don't you think? I mean, if this is a time of Thanksgiving and Christmas, we ought to be doing that.
If you go down to the ball, it's already in Christmas mode. But I'm not ready to let go of Thanksgiving just yet. But
such as it is, we're going to talk about Thanksgiving this morning. I'd like to ask that you pray for me. Turn to the book of Esther, if you would, please. We're going to go through that.
I know we've all heard this before. I know we all love this story. But I think it's important that we understand the great lessons that are taught for us in this great book. This is the story of the Jewish Thanksgiving. It's a festival that they have every spring called Purim, and they hold it to this day. If you buy a calendar for somebody as a Christmas gift and you flip through there, you'll probably see sometime in the spring Purim. And this is the origin of that festival. Now, Brother David Piles was here back in September, and some of you may have got to hear him preach for us. He made a point that I thought was quite interesting, and since then I've kind of checked it out, and I tend to agree with him. He said that a lot of times when we look at the Bible and we think about the people who lived in the Bible and that their lives are recorded for us, that it would have been a very common occurrence to see miracles, to see wonders and signs that, you know, you read through the Bible and you see all of these wonderful things that are being done openly to the glory of God. But he said, you know, in reality, he said that the vast majority, he petted at about 90%, and I think that's about right, About 90% of all the miracles, and by miracles I mean in an open, overt way, parting of the Red Sea, that kind of thing, were only performed by four men. That is, most of the miracles in the Bible are really accounted by and during the lifetimes of four men. Moses, Elijah, Elisha, and of course the Lord Jesus. That's not to say that other men didn't do miracles. We know that James and Peter were walking by the temple. We read about this in Acts chapter 3 where they healed the man who was lame and so on. But the vast majority of the signs and wonders that are in the scriptures were done in particularly important times. The time of the giving of the law with Moses. The time of the great apostasy to the nation of Israel. Elijah and his successor, Elisha. That was, you know, we preached to you before about King Ahab and all the Baal worship that's going on in the land of Israel at that time. And of course, at the coming of the Lord Jesus Christ. That's why I like the book of Esther so much, because that means that most of the people whose lives we read about in the scriptures weren't accustomed to waking up and seeing these kinds of signs and wonders. They did have the word of God and the fulfillment of the prophecy of God. And I think that that's one of the things that the Bible teaches us. You know, sometimes we might say, boy, it'd be really good if I could just see a miracle. If God would just, you know, do something like turn the fleece wet for me like he did for Gideon, you know, or make it dry or open the Red Sea or do something, boy, my faith would be enhanced. I'm here to tell you that that's not really the case. Truly not. Because when we read about the nation of Israel and we see that they parted on dry land through the Red Sea to escape Pharaoh's army, and they see all of the destruction, they see the dead bodies on the seashore, they see the wreckage. 3 days later, they're complaining because they don't have any water. And they're accusing God of leading them out into the desert to kill them. Okay? And that's why I think that a miracle only lasts you about 3 days. it's about how long it lasts, you know? The Jews came to Jesus. They had seen all these miracles that he had done. And they said, Master, give us a sign. And he said, there's not going to be any sign given you. You're an adulterous and wicked generation. You're not interested in what I have to say. There's no sign going to be given you except that of the prophet Jonah, right? Because as Jonah was in the belly of the whale for 3 days and three nights, so shall the Son of Man be in the heart of the earth for 3 days and three nights. And we know that that was fulfilled by his death, burial, and resurrection. Okay? Again, that's why I like the book of Esther. Because we might not see miracles. And again, it's how you define it. We've all seen miracles in our lives. We've seen miraculous things. We all know that. But there's something else I want to talk about, and that is the providence of God. God's providing of his grace and his mercy to us in the background, seemingly by coincidence, and yet it's like the air. It's all around us. It's like the air that we breathe. God is always moving in our lives and doing things, just like is illustrated in this book. This is a very interesting book. The name of the Lord is never named, and yet he's on every page. And it's a great story, and I'd like to turn there with us, and I'd like you to turn there with me as we go through it today. I'd like to ask that you pray for me, the book of Esther in the Old Testament. Esther was a woman who was the wife, as we're going to learn in just a moment, of a man who's identified in the scriptures as Ahasuerus. And I've come to realize that Ahasuerus did not necessarily identify a particular man. That was a title. It's like Pharaoh in Egypt. There were many pharaohs, depending on who was king. In the Roman Empire, they had somebody called the emperor or the Caesar. And he was different named. Ahasuerus, I believe, is a Persian term for that same being, that same character. We believe this was Xerxes the First, a man who, those of you who watched the movie 300 a few years ago, he was the guy who was the king. He wasn't this big, tall, black guy, kind of, you know, androgynous guy. That's not who Xerxes of history was. But he was that character. He was the one, in fact, who led the Persian armies into the invasion of Greece, unsuccessfully, ultimately. But it's the same character who we're talking about. And indeed, some scholars believe that this was the campaign that he was actually planning as we open the story. I'm not going to read all of this to you. I'm going to give you the highlights of it. I do commend it to your reading as we go through here and see the mighty works of God in his great providence for his people. It says, now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, and he says, this is Ahasuerus which reigned from India even unto Ethiopia, over 107 and 20 provinces. This was at the height of the Persian Empire. Remember that this time the Jews had been set free from their captivity under the Babylonians, and they had been allowed to return and rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. But all the Jews in the world were still under Persian rule. That will be important in a moment. This is in that in those days when the king Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan, the palace, in Susa, we know where that is, in the third year of his reign, and he began reigning in about 486 BC, he made a feast unto all his princes and his servants, and the power of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of the provinces being before him, where he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the honor of his excellent majesty many days, even 104 days. 180 days, he has this giant feast in his palace and has everybody from all over his kingdom come and be with him. And as I said before, there is good reason to believe that perhaps he was planning certain military campaigns. There was a campaign against the Babylonians in this time. There was a campaign against the Egyptians. And there was also a campaign against the Greeks. And it may have been very well that this man, who, as we will see through as we study the scriptures, this is a good man, but he's kind of gullible and he's kind of clueless. He's very trusting and those around him when he shouldn't be. He's kind of like Jehoshaphat, the king that we were talking about the other day when we were preaching, a man who perhaps had his heart in the right place, but at the same time was not making good judgment, especially about the people that was giving him advice. You get the sense that King Xerxes, who's a young king and he has grand plans and schemes, he's really into buying into people's, buying into the kingdom. He wants unity. He wants people to get with the program. He wants everybody to be happy and excited and united, as we'll see in a moment. Anyway, during this feast, it lasts for a while. It says for 180 days, which is a long party. And at the end of that 180 days, he concludes it. I guess he sends most of the people home, but those who are left, they have a seven-day wine drinking feast. Okay, and so they eat each day, and they drink a lot of wine, and then no doubt they get a little tipsy and impaired in their judgment. And he was married to a woman by the name of Vashti, who was a very beautiful woman. And at one point, he commands that she come and appear before him and all of his friends. Some scholars have suggested that the commandment was a little bit more explicit than that, that she appear with not many clothes on, if not any at all. But regardless of however it was a very inappropriate thing that the king had asked the woman to do. And for the sake of not only her own glory and her own modesty, but also for that, for the king, she refused. Now, this is one of the things that we learn about the Persian Empire, is that you don't refuse the king. You don't get to do that. This is not a democracy. This is not a republic. This is a tyranny, and this man has absolute power over life and death. And so, at this moment, because his wife has refused to come and appear before him, his counselors give him some very bad advice. They try to make a big deal out of this, and you kind of wonder if maybe there's some palace intrigue behind this. But one of his friends says to him that because she has refused, this is going to be all mayhem throughout all your kingdom. All the women in your kingdom are going to hear that Queen Vashti refused the commandment of the king, and so they're all going to get uppity. They're all going to get uppity. We got to smash this. So you need to divorce her. You need to get rid of her and never see her again. So he agreed to that, and he signed a proclamation that said that Vashti has been fired from her role as queen. One of the interesting things we learn about Persian law is that when the king gives a command, when there's a writing made and he signs it and seals it with the signet of his ring, then it is spoken, it is done. The Persians believe that the kings of Media and Persia spoke through the gods in those times, and therefore the king himself was bound by his own decree. We learn about that in the book of Daniel. Remember in the sixth chapter when Daniel's an old man and the king foolishly gives an edict that says that no petition can be made to any man or person or any other god except for the king for 30 days. And by this, the enemies of Daniel entrapped him because he wasn't going to give up praying to God, and he was cast into the den of lions. Of course, he passed the night very comfortably in that state. But the king stayed up all night trying to figure out how he could undo his own work. Well, the same is true here. Queen Vashti is divorced from the king, and he never sees her again. Now, when you get to chapter 2, and again, we got to understand that whether that was a good thing or a bad thing, God's providence is always working in the background. He is always directing the events in our lives. And the same God who, as we're going to read about in this book, is at work in your life too. He is working behind the scenes. He is pulling together events, some good, some maybe not so fun. But in the end, when you look back, you will see that God likewise has moved in a glorious fashion. And here, this was the first move in a very long chess game, as God, who does things with such great style, is about to save his people from certain destruction. Don't you agree? It's pretty cool, isn't it? Okay, what do you think so far? Pretty good story, right? Okay, all right, well, read it all. Read it all, it's there. They ought to make a movie out of this, because this is really good. In chapter 2, we find that it's some period of time has elapsed. Again, I'm led to believe that this was the time after he went and attempted to invade Greece and came back dejected. He's obviously sad. It says that he's downcast. History tells us Herodotus is a famous historian, and he says that King Xerxes put together an army of 1 million men, which is phenomenal. I don't know if it was that large or not, but I do know it was a very massive group of people to go invade Greece and add them to his empire, add them to the Persian Empire. They actually built a bridge across the strait at the mouth of the Black Sea. You know, there's an isthmus there near Constantinople, near Istanbul. They actually built a bridge and they went by land to invade Greece. And of course, you know the story how that they were held up at Thermopylae and eventually defeated at Salamis and other places. But anyway, he comes back and chapter 2 tells us that after these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus was appeased, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what was decreed against her. He's kind of lonely and dejected. So his friends come to him and say, well, I'll tell you what you need to do is find you a new queen, a better queen, someone who's much better than Vashti, and everything will be fine. And so the king agreed, and they began to go about and collect women throughout all of the kingdom who were eligible, young maidens, who could come and interview for the position. And they went through a beauty spa. They would spend 6 months or more going through, learning how to stand in front of the king. They would have beauty treatments and everything. And then every so often, I don't know how many women were involved in this, but every so often there would be a candidate who was ready, and she would go in to the king, and they would spend the night together. And she would become his wife or a part of his harem. In the morning, he would ask her, what would you like? He would offer her anything up to the half of her kingdom. And, you know, different women might ask for different things. They might desire some jewels. They might desire a horse to ride. They might desire some money or lands for their family. All manner of gifts were given. And then that woman would then go and be a part of the harem. Well, we're introduced to this young lady who is a Jew whose name was Hadassah, which means myrtle, which is a beautiful flower. And her Persian name was Esther. She was an orphan. She was raised by her cousin Mordecai, who was apparently older than her. And she was selected to be a part of this program. We don't know how old she was, but she was a young lady. And Mordecai told her two things. Again, by the providence of God, there's no real danger to this, but he says, do not reveal to the king or to anyone else that you are a Jew, and then do not reveal our relationship, that the fact that I'm your uncle or I'm your cousin. And so she does. She goes in, and just like everybody else, she goes through the beauty spa treatment. She goes in to the king, becomes his wife. In the morning, though, something very miraculous happens, because the king turns to her and says, what would you like? I'll give you anything up to half my kingdom. And she says, you know, I don't really want anything. I'm content with all that you provided me. You've been very sweet to me. The people that are in charge of me have given me all that I need, and I don't need anything. Now, you young ladies, let me say something to you right now. If you want to be alluring, if you would like to make a statement, then don't ask for things, because you will drive your men crazy, because they will try to figure out what it is to give you. Okay? And you see this theme throughout this. Okay? This is important, again, by the Spirit of God. But you get a sense of her godliness. You get a sense of her contentment. You get a sense that this is a really fine woman. And the king agreed, because after a while it became evidently clear that she was a wonderful woman. And the king elevated her to the queenhood, and she became the queen of the entire Persian army. Just like you know, like Joseph or others have been elevated through the stories. Here is a woman now who is now queen of the entire Persian Empire. And as far as we can tell, there was a lot of affection between the couple. Now, one more thing happens now that she's been elevated to the position of queen. Mordecai is a mid-level state manager. We don't know what he does. He serves in the king's palace. He's some sort of administrator. And he uncovers a plot against the life of the king. He realizes that there are two chamberlains, two attendants, two bodyguards perhaps. These are men who have access to the king's person. And Mordecai is able to discover that they are wroth and angry and they are conspiring to assassinate the king. And so he certifies this to Queen Esther, and she tells the king about it. There's an investigation made, and in fact, it turns out to be true, that these men were in fact going to kill the king, and you know, the plot is uncovered, and they are executed, and there's a record made of that. At this time, Mordecai does not receive any payment or any kind of recognition or anything. That's going to be very important in just a moment. But I want you to see that so far, we have just a bunch of ordinary, seemingly ordinary events taking place in the lives of these people. Certainly nothing noteworthy. And yet God's providence is right at hand. He is driving all of these events because God knows what's going to happen. We don't. I don't know why we question God so oftentimes. We say, God, what are you doing? Why are things happening in my life? If we would stop and think about the fact that God has seen eternity and played it backwards, He knows exactly everything that's going to happen. Surely we should trust His will and His decisions and His direction in our lives, because certainly that will be what is best for us. We cannot see everything. We can only see a short way, but we trust one who can see it all and loves us and will provide for us and provide all of our needs and protection in times of danger. Okay, as we continue on through this great story, and I hope that you're continuing to enjoy it as much as I do, there's a man named Haman. Haman. Now, if we were in a synagogue and we were celebrating Purim, every time his name was named, everybody would boo and hiss and make a lot of noise because he's a very, very wicked man. He's the evil villain in this story. For reasons that are not clear to us in the scriptures, this man is elevated to a position of prime minister. He is second in command in this kingdom. This man is obviously a very wicked man. He's a very a crafty man, a very clever man, a very intelligent man. He's very self-righteous. I think he has design on the king. He'd like to be the king someday. But for whatever reason, he is elevated to the position of second only to the king. In fact, he's like a vizier, maybe, or a prime minister. I don't know if you watched Aladdin, but remember that evil guy? What was his name? Do you remember? Jafar. Yeah, remember he was evil, and you're like, how could a king have such a wicked man and not get it? Well, it actually happened at least once, and it probably happened all the time. Probably happens all the time today. But anyway, Haman discovers that Mordecai, well, first of all, Haman gets the king to say, have everybody, whenever he walks into a room, everybody bows down and worships him. And it's not just a sign of respect, it's a worship, and Mordecai, being a Jew, refuses. And so it becomes to Haman's attention that there's this uppity upstart man who's refusing to bow when he walks into a room, and it makes him really angry because Haman desires the worship and the adulation of those around him. And when Haman discovers that Mordecai is a Jew, he's not content to just have Mordecai killed. Oh, no, no, no. He's got much greater plans than this. Satan always works in a very strange way, and Satan's going to use this as an opportunity to try to wipe out all the seed of Israel, which is something that Satan's been trying to do from the beginning. And so what Haman does is he rolls dice. He rolls pure. I don't know if they're dice or not. But there's some sort of thing, some sort of lot that you cast. Brother Alan, do you know what they were? They were some sort of thing that had numbers on them, obviously, or there were numbers of them. But anyway, he cast pur to go to his gods to try to figure out when would be the opportune time to kill all the Jews in the world. When would be? I mean, that's a pretty brutal guy, isn't it? But he inquires of his gods when would be the best time, and he comes up with the date of the 13th day of the 12th month of that year. This was still several months out, maybe 8 or 9 months in the future. Again, once again, God cast the dice and caused it to be far enough in the future that God could resolve this issue. And so then Haman goes to the king and says, you've got a people among you You've got a group of people that are subjects in your kingdom that are not loyal to you. They do not obey your laws. They do not listen to what you have to say. Their loyalties are divided. If another enemy kingdom came in, like the Greeks say, and invaded, they might join them. These are bad guys. These are not on board in your unity plan. These guys do not play ball. And so the king didn't even inquire as to who they were. He says, well, do whatever you'd like. And he says, well, I'll tell you what I'd like to do. I'd like to have them all put to death. But so you don't lose out on all your tax revenues, I'll deliver 10,000 talents into your coffers. In other words, you're going to lose a few million subjects, but I'll make sure you don't lose any money on it. The king says, that's fine. You can keep the silver. Don't worry about it. Just do what you think is right. Obviously, that wasn't a good way to administer a kingdom. But he handed him his ring. And so Haman makes a decree, and it says that on the 13th day of the 12th month, all the Jews can be killed in the kingdom. That it's open season. It's duck season. It's rabbit season. But it's Jew season. And it says that on this day, if there is a Jewish family nearby, or you can go kill them all with impunity. It's not murder. It's sanctioned by the king. And you can have all their stuff. You can steal all their lands. You can steal all their gold. And remember what I said to you earlier. In the Persian Empire, once a writing was made like that and it was signed by the signet, you couldn't take it back. So this was a very, very distressful thing. So it says in chapter 4, when Mordecai perceived all that was done, Mordecai rent his clothes, put on sackcloth with ashes, and went out to the midst of the city and cried with a loud and a bitter cry, and came even before the king's gate, for none might enter into the king's gate clothed with sackcloth. And in every province, whithersoever the king's commandment and his decree came, there was great mourning among the Jews, and fasting, and weeping, and wailing. And many lay in sackcloth and ashes. This was a very hard position. This was a very serious problem. This was a very difficult issue. There was no way out, and the Jews, of course, were alarmed by this. As we continue reading this chapter, we find that Mordecai went and through an emissary who traveled between him and the queen, he wasn't allowed to go and talk to Esther directly. He sent word to her and sent a copy of the writing so that she might know. She lives up in the palace. She might not have even known that this had gone forth and been published throughout all the land. And he sends that to her and says, you've got to do something about this. You've got to talk to the king. You've got to put a stop to this. And this is very interesting. And Hatak, who was the eunuch who was being the messenger boy, Hatak came and told Esther the words of Mordecai. And Esther spake unto Hatak and gave him commandment unto Mordecai. This is verse 10. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces do know that whosoever, whether men or women, shall come into the king, into the inner court, who is not called, there is one law of his to put him to death, except such to whom the king shall hold out the golden scepter that he may live. But I have not been called to come in unto the king these 30 days. She says, I may be queen, but that doesn't mean I can just walk in and talk to the king. You know, the rules apply to me as well. If the king's sitting in his throne room and you show up uninvited, unless the king puts forth his scepter so you can touch it and you're safe, you're immediately executed. It says, I don't need to remind you that a few years ago there was this queen called Vashti. Remember her? And, you know, and not only that, the king hasn't seen me for 30 days. I haven't seen him for a month. You know, his passions have cooled toward me. I can't do anything. And notice what Mordecai says. Mordecai commanded to answer Esther. This is verse 13. Think not with thyself that thou shalt escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. What does that mean? It means God's going to save us anyway. If you don't do anything, God's still going to save us. But thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed. You won't be a part of that. And who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this. And that's really what Mordecai's getting at. He says, who knows, Esther? Maybe God made you queen for this purpose. Maybe this is the very reason from the beginning that God planned for you to be queen so that when this emergency came up, when this problem, trouble came, you would be in the exact right place to do that which God would have you do. Now let me ask you guys something. Does God ever put you in places where perhaps, just perhaps, maybe God has a reason and a purpose for you? You might not know it at the time, but perhaps, just perhaps, this is how God rules this world. That whatever we do, whether we're in a big station or a small, whatever it is, we need to think about when we're thinking about our own lives and we're wondering, why does God have us do this? Perhaps God has a reason. Perhaps God has a purpose, and that will be revealed to us in due time. So Mordecai says, maybe. He doesn't say, I know for sure. But that's what faith is all about. He says, perhaps this is why you've been brought to the position of being queen. And notice what Esther says. Then Esther bade them return Mordecai this answer. Go gather together all the Jews that are present in Shushan and fast ye for me, and neither eat nor drink 3 days, night or day. I also and my maidens will fast likewise. And so will I go into the king, which is not according to the law. And if I perish, I perish. And Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther had commanded him. So she said, you guys go and pray for me. You get together with all the Jews in Shushan and you pray for 3 days and three nights. And you fast and you pray that God will give me success. I will do that with my maidens. And at the end of that period of time, I will go into the king. And if I perish, I perish. Now, I want to think about that. I want to make an aside just for a moment. This was a great statement of faith on the part of Esther. This was not, as you might consider it, a position of great defeat. She's not saying, well, if I perish, I perish. You know, like she's given up. It's not a fatalistic giving up. She's putting all of her hope and trust in God. We read in the scriptures about Elijah. Remember I mentioned him earlier? Remember he had that great showdown on Mount Carmel when the fire came down from heaven and consumed the altar. And he said, God is, you've turned your back on God, you nation of Israel, but God has not turned his back on you. And he is receiving you back. And you just get the sense that Elijah was so excited. He was, this was the culmination of all the things that had happened before. And you know, we had a famine for 3.5 years and God fed me by the ravens and he fed me with the crews that never ran out and the meal. And this is it. We're finally there. And you know what? It didn't do any good at all because Jezebel sent word that said, you know, by this time tomorrow, you and all your prophets are going to be dead. And he ran like a jackrabbit, you know, and he got out of Dodge. Maybe he was built up a little bit. But you know what he did? What he did? He wandered out in the wilderness and he said, God, let me die. He says, you know, my life is just a huge failure. Just let me die. Take my life, Lord. You know, kind of what Job was saying. I wish I'd never been born. You know, God very graciously brought him up. We, if we're honest, we get there sometimes. Those of you who are young, you might not have gone through enough troubles yet, but there's going to be a time when you kind of feel that way sometimes. You know, you just do. All I can say is that God still loves you, even if you are a failure, even if you do give up. And he'll forgive those moments of depression and doubt. But that's not what's going on here. I don't believe that's her state at all. I don't think she's saying, if I perish, I perish. No, she's like the Apostle Paul, who wrote in the book of Philippians, where he said, you know, I'm in prison, and my time might be up. He says, but for me to live is Christ and die is gain. My heart's desire is to go on and be with Christ, which is far better. But to be here with you is more needful. She's at the point now where she says, you know, my life belongs to God. And if I die, I die. If that's His will, I'm going to do it. But if I live, I'll live. You have to get to that point before really you're going to be of much use to God. Where you finally are out of rope. You no longer know what to do. She can't see any way out of this. Why did she ask her maidens to pray for her? Why did she ask the Jews to give her some idea what to do? She had no idea, but she was willing to trust God and do what she thought was best. And you know what? When you get to that point, you might be worth something to the Lord. The Lord might be able to use you to His glory. You know, your life. And this is where the story turns over. We don't know it yet, but here's the story. And I will hurry. I am watching it. Okay, but here's what's really cool about that. After 3 days, she washed herself and put on her dress and put on her crown and appeared before the door. You can imagine, you know, back here, she's standing in the doorway and the king's sitting up here and there's two guys standing with swords or axes or something ready to chop, you know, ready to haul her off and kill her. But the king holds out his scepter to her and she comes out and she touches it, which means that it's okay for her to be there. And he says, what would you like? And she says, I'd like to have a banquet. I'd like to invite you and Haman, if you would, come with dine with me tonight. And I get the sense that this is probably the first time she's ever asked for anything. And the interesting thing is that it's clear, by implication, that at this banquet, she's going to tell the king what her desire is. In other words, the desire is not just to have dinner, but that she's going to make her request there. And the king's overjoyed. I mean, this is great. Okay, finally. She told me what she wants. I mean, my goodness, I don't have to sit there and guess. Okay? And you guys who are getting ready for Christmas, you know exactly what I'm talking about. You know? If you loved me, you'd know what I want for Christmas. Okay. Okay. Well, I do, and I don't. Okay, you got to spell it out for me. All right, anyway. So they have the banquet, and during this banquet, you know, it's just the three of them, and they're having a nice banquet, and the king turns to Esther and says, "What would you like?" And she loses her nerve. I think that she thought that she'd tell him there. I think her plan was, let's be alone, and I will reveal that I'm a Jew, and I will tell him about this plot against Haman. But she just doesn't feel right in her spirit. She just can't do it. She hesitates. She says, my desire is that we have another banquet tomorrow night. Okay? And I'll tell you then. Now, guys, when she said, God, show me what to do, it came into her mind to have a banquet, but that's about all the light she had. And when it came time, her expectation was that she could tell him then. She didn't know what else to do, so she followed her heart, she trusted her spirit, and she said, let's do it tomorrow night. Now, that doesn't make any sense at all. What is one more day going to matter, right? I mean, what, Brother Alan, what's one day? How different would it be? Might as well tell him tonight. But you know what? When you give up trying to figure it out on your own and you trust God and let God lead you, wonderful things happen. So, watch what happens. This is when it gets really fun. This is a great story. Haman goes home. He's on top of the world. He is so excited. He says, you know what? I just had dinner with the king and the queen. It was awesome. It was so much fun. And as he's walking out, it just so happens, mind you, Mordecai happened to be working late at the office. And he sees Mordecai. And all of a sudden, he's filled with rage. Okay? How did Mordecai get there? Maybe the providence of God. I don't know. Maybe. Yeah. Maybe. But anyway, Haman, instead of being on top of the world, now he is full of wrath and anger. And he gets home and he complains to his wife. And he says, you know what? I had a great time tonight. I got to hang out with the king and the queen, and I'd be on top of the world except that dirty, stinking rat, Mordecai. I can't stand him. Oh, I hate him. I hate him. And the queen says, well, you know, you don't have to wait until the 13th day of the 12th month. Why don't you go ask the king if you can kill him tomorrow? I mean, he's giving you everything else you wanted. And he says, you know what? That is a good idea. And so he sets his workmen to work that night. And they probably work on it throughout the day. They build a gallows. Do you guys know what a gallows is? Remember in the Old West where somebody was, you know, convicted in all the old movies? They would be convicted of murder. And if they were, they'd build the gallows out in the middle of the street. Well, this was like that. It was a big wooden platform with a crossbeam. And they were going to hang, he was going to hang Mordecai from it. But this wasn't just an ordinary gallows. This gallows was 75 feet in the air. Okay, it was high enough. What his plan was to put Mordecai's body way up there where everybody in town could see it. And he was going to say, this is what happens if you mess with Haman. Okay, don't you mess with Haman. Mordecai disrespected me. Look at where he is. You'd better get in line. That's his pride. It's also his downfall. Because you see, it's now chapter 6. We've had this big banquet. We've had this big meal. We've had this big feast. I don't know how you guys felt about, oh, I don't know, about 2:30 or 3 o'clock on Thursday, but I was sound asleep from a big, heavy meal. But the king couldn't sleep. No, he was wide awake, and it was annoying him. He couldn't get to sleep. And he, instead of calling for someone from his harem, instead of calling for a musician, he says, let the chronicles of my kingdom be read to me. No doubt he was saying, that'll be so boring. You know, it's got to put me to sleep. And so they start reading to him, and he's sitting there in bed listening. And all of a sudden, they read about this time when Mordecai saved his life. Oh, that's interesting. Oh, another little coincidence. It just so happens that they turn to the section of the Chronicles where several years prior, Mordecai had saved the king's life, had discovered this. And one of the things that the king says is, well, what's been done for Mordecai? And they said, "Well, nothing. You didn't do anything." And so he's sitting there going, "You know, that's the kind of guy. That's the kind of behavior I'm looking for. He's a team player. He gets this. He's on the program. You know, this is the kind of thing we want people to save the king's life. You know, this is a good thing. We need to honor Mordecai." And what's really funny is by that time the sun was coming up and Haman was outside because he couldn't wait to get in and ask the king if he could kill Mordecai. And the king, just at that very moment, was thinking about how he might honor Mordecai. Isn't that cool? That's not coincidence. It's the providence of God. God does this all the time. He does this in your life. Maybe not in such a dramatic fashion, but God is in charge. This is why we have Thanksgiving. To thank God for His providence. Because it's God's providing grace for us to keep us safe, keep us happy, keep us healthy, take care of us. God does this all the time. And so here we find Haman is outside the bedchamber. He had special privileges of being number two. He could come in. And so the king invites him in. And, you know, if you're the king, you get to go first. They both had something they wanted to say, but the king gets to go first. And the king said, "You know, what would you do if there was somebody that the king delighted to honor? You know, what? Give me an idea. I got somebody I want to honor. I need some suggestions." And of course, Haman, in his evil, self-absorbed way, notice how God is causing him to show his hand. You know, he's hidden this a long time, but now it's being revealed. The state of his heart is being shown. And he says, "Well, who would the king delight to honor in more than me?" So he sets his day. He says, "You know what? You should have the man that you want to honor. You should have your best noble put your robe on him. And put your crown on him. And put him on your best horse. And have that nobleman lead him through the town saying, 'This is a man that the king delights to honor in.'" You know, and Haman's sitting there going, this is going to be a great day. Yeah, because this is what's going to happen to me. And the king turns to Haman and says, "Great. Go do that for Mordecai." Okay? You know? God has such style. God, when God destroys you, He destroys you. God knows how to make the wicked and the proud fall. So here Haman had no choice. He had to go. This man that he hated, this man that he showed up at the door to ask if he could have put to death, he had to put his robe on him, had to put the crown on him, had to help him get up on the horse. Just this way, the horse, lead him around. This was not a good day for Haman. But it gets worse. Because he got home that night and he covered his head and he was full of shame. He was so dejected, and that's when the attendants show up and say, "Oh, by the way, you've got dinner with the king and the queen tonight." And now it's a very different feeling for Haman as he goes to this, and his wife isn't much help. Says, "Well, it looks like it's all over for you. You know, if you've begun to fall before Mordecai, you're going to fall." And so now we find that in chapter 7, we have the second banquet. Remember, what can happen in 24 hours? What difference can a day make? It can make a whole lot of difference if God is at hand, at work. You see that? Sometimes we spend a lot of time praying for something and we don't know what to do. We beseech the Lord. We try to know what to do. We don't know. And all of a sudden God just puts it all together. Has that ever happened in your life? Where God just solves a problem really fast. And then you look back and you go, you had such style. That was so awesome. That's what God would have us do, is acknowledge His grace and His glory. So here we have the king and Haman came to the banquet with Esther the queen, seventh time. And this time, the king turns to Esther and says, "What would you have? What would you like? You've never asked me for anything. I'm now going to give it to you. Please, please tell me." Okay? And she says, "I want to ask for the life of myself and for the life of my people. I'm a Jew. And an enemy has come in and is going to destroy all of us." And this, of course, enraged the king. He didn't know any idea. And says, "Who's this enemy?" And says, "This wicked Haman." And now it's beginning to, this king, he's kind of slow, but he's starting to get it, okay? He's starting to understand what's going on. And he goes out of the room because he's angry, because here's a man who has threatened his wife. It doesn't matter that he didn't know that. Here's a man who has threatened to kill his wife. So he's very angry, very, very possessive. During that time, Haman, the snake weasel that he is, falls on the couch to beg his life of Esther. What a rat. And weasel. Yeah, he is a weasel. Yeah. The world's full of people like Haman. You don't think God knows how to deal with them? He can, and he does. So don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. God knows how to protect us and keep us safe. But anyway, King comes in and says, is it not enough that you're going to try to kill her? You would force yourself on my wife too. And they grab him. And one of the guards says, you know, Haman built a gallows for Mordecai, the man that saved your life. And he says, go hang Haman on those gallows. And so they did. They drug him out that night. And Haman was the one whose body was hanging above the city. Okay? God knows how to save us. The nation of Israel was never in any danger. It seemed that way, but there are no problems too hard for God. And he very easily took care of this problem. Except, we still have the problem of this pronouncement. There's still this decree. There's still this decree that's, it's still months away, but there's still this open season on the Jewish people. But you know what? Esther brings in Mordecai and explains to the king who he is, that this is the man who raised me. This is my kin. And of course, King's going, well, this is great. You get Haman's job. Okay? You know? And whatever you want to do, you do it. And so they do. They make another pronouncement. They can't get rid of the old one, so they put a new one out. And it says that on that day, the Jews are allowed to arm themselves and kill anyone who would attack them. Okay? And this is published throughout all the land. And what's really great about this story, as you look at it, is that the Jews became in great favor among the Persians. That they saw Mordecai, what an upstanding individual he was. No doubt there were many people who were aggrieved at Haman, but they were excited about Mordecai. It says in the scriptures that there were many people who converted and became Jews during this period of time. Now think about that. They actually converted to the Jewish religion. There's a death sentence coming up. Do you think they're afraid of that? Not at all. They're like, I want in on this. The God of Israel is the real God, and I want to worship him. I went in on this. So the day came, and I will shut this down quickly because we are out of time. But the day came, and there was a great rout. The Jews were able to destroy all of their enemies. It says about 75,000 were killed. All the sons of Haman were destroyed. And, you know, none of the Jews were harmed. None of their stuff was taken. God brought great deliverance to the Jewish nation at this time. And that was the basis for the festival of Purim, which was a festival that they commemorated each day. And these are the final verses that I want to read to you. It says that they sent out a decree. In verse 18, this is the ninth chapter, it says, but the Jews that were in Shushan assembled together on the 13th day thereof, and on the 14th day thereof, and on the 15th day of the same day, they rested and made it a day of feasting and gladness. Therefore, the Jews of the villages that dwelt in the unwalled towns made the 14th day of the month of Adar a day of gladness and feasting and a good day and of sending portions, that is, gifts, one to another. It became an annual celebration, a day of thanksgiving, a time when you reflect upon the providence of God, a time when you feast and you get together with your friends and you help, you know, you send gifts one to another and you rejoice. That's what Thanksgiving is all about. It's not... Being thankful, we ought to be thankful in our prayers. We ought to thank God when we pray. Although if you'll notice in the model prayer that Jesus gave us, there aren't any actual thanks. They're all petitions. There were times when Jesus did pray and thanked his Father. But being thankful is more than just saying a prayer, thank you, God. It's an attitude. It's a way of looking at life. Being grateful, being thankful means that you recognize, your eyes are open, and you see the providence of God. You see His blessings all around you, and you are truly appreciative and grateful for all that He has done. And that's what Thanksgiving is all about. In the book of 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, rejoice evermore and pray without ceasing, and in everything give thanks, for this is the will of God in Christ Jesus concerning you. Let us learn the lesson that the Jewish nation did, the great deliverance of God. Let's be thankful that we live in a nation that lets us live as free men and women, and let us be thankful truly to God. There are dark times ahead. Of course there are. There were dark times in the story I just read to you, but God is on the throne, and God's providence is always near. I thank you for your kind attention. May God bless you. I hope you had a very happy Thanksgiving season.